And was Dr. and Future and Mrs. Future, are they around?
Yes. We are in the house.
Wow, we almost got Scott to tell us what every man in the world wants.
What, and a Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
Oh, I did a lot on that in my first hour.
I know.
I like what, like you said, it's not like all gay couples in Massachusetts, it's not like they're molesting our children all the time. Well, maybe they take weekends off. I don't know. Maybe they sleep and eat. But besides that, the implication was that gay couples are molesting our children all the time. They're not. That's just sad. That's sad.
That's kind of like the Germans eating babies or band-aiding babies in World War One.
Well, they didn't bayonet them all the time.
Yeah, right. Right, exactly. I know. The popular mythos just keep going until people get to know people as people. And until then, it's just stereotypes.
Well, you got a minute and a half to wow me. What's going to go on your show?
Well, we are going to have Deborah Artura coming on at 2:40. She's got a magical and true Father's Day tale.
A magical
and true Father's Day tale. Yeah, so something that she did that was really amazing with her dad, who she had been somewhat estranged from, and she did a special thing with him that's turned everything around. And she's going to be talking that at 2:40.
Okay.
And at 3:06, we'll have the two people that will be talking about science and spirituality, particularly on the civilization-ending events. We have one who's a geologist who is an expert on big things like the Yellowstone caldera.
Right.
What would happen if it went off?
It would be bad.
The theme of the show, Corey, is surviving the future.
Yeah, surviving the future. We're dealing with some of the doomsday tales. And then we also have with him, we have, just to keep the hope alive, we have Julia Bastrova, who is into solutions. You know, so we have an earthquake, what do you do? If we have a caldera explode, what do you do?
And Julia has been very involved with the transitions groups, and she lives up in Sebastopol. So she's going to talk to us about Transitions Sebastopol community ideas.
Yeah. We got 3 seconds left, so have a great show.
Thank you, Corey.
Thanks, Corey.
Have a day off.
Time now for What's Left and Dr. Future on AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz.
Welcome, everyone, to the Dr. Future Show. Dr. Future here with Mrs. Future.
Hello.
And Agent Nada.
Hello, Dr. Future.
What are you girls doing over there by the controls here? Are you conspiring against me or something?
We're conspiring for you.
Oh, okay.
We're conspiring with you.
Oh, of course. Silly me.
Yes, thanks for giving us the controls, Dr. Future. We really like to drive.
Well, I'm trying to keep this male-female balance thing.
You keep it working. Yeah.
Good. Well, I hope you'll like our choice of stories this week. We've definitely have a lot of male-female balance elements that we've considered. Like for example, Saturday was TEDx here in Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
And there was an interesting gender balance there.
That's right. That was, we believe, the first TEDx in history to have more than 50% women.
Or on parity. Actually, 50-50, even parity, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, did it make a different kind of TED, do you think? A TEDx? Having more, so much feminine influence on content?
I think it did. I think that compared to other TEDs that I've seen, there was much more interest in women's issues. There were a lot more kind of, I guess you would say, family-related issues. There were more... there was some fashion-related issues. Of course, TED is technology, entertainment, and design.
Yeah, that's I feel thousands of people saying, what is TED? If you tell them.
Okay.
I'm not sure many of you know, of course.
So TED is an acronym for
technology, entertainment, and design.
Started by our sister in our sister town, Monterey, back in 1984. It became the premier event where technologists, educators, and designers could meet and cross-pollinate their knowledge from their fields.
And the TED motto of ideas worth spreading is one that has attracted lots of visionary people all over the world for over 20 years. And they've actually instituted a lot of their programs. I would say current TV came out of TED.
A lot of things came out of it. What was interesting is that it did become a very she-she event. It cost not only did you have to be invited to go after a few years, you had to also pay like $6,000 for the privilege of speaking, not just going, but just speaking. And it became one of the most shishi, high mind events on the planet.
Dr. Future, didn't you meet Vice President Gore there?
I did.
The former.
You actually rub shoulders with people like Bill Gates and Steve Wozniak.
Sergey Brin.
Yeah, and you know, all these people.
What's the Virgin guy? Richard Branson.
Richard Branson.
Sir Richard.
But what's funny is that, you know, what we're realizing is that there actually were amazing minds out there, and they were brought together, and they could do amazing things. And it was mind-blowing, so much so that the TED organization decided to just publish all these things online and put them on YouTube and incredible
That's right.
talks. On
so you can go to TED.com yeah. and see an amazing archive of speakers over the last 20 years.
All done in, so that people delivered their talks very quickly and to the point. I think they're 12-minute and 18-minute segments. Very interesting.
I think it's like 8, 12, and 18.
Yeah, number of short format talks.
And
with
I'm
a
sure our audience, after we've done a couple of shows on TED and just our audience being our audience.
Yeah, they probably know this. This is just more of a background
to
piece.
Check out a lot of the TED talks.
Then there's TEDx.
Yeah, and TEDx happened. Well, I think actually TEDx came from Bill, personally.
There was Bill.
Yeah, there's TED and Bill.
There's still Bill, right?
There are a few bills, yes.
Now, what I mean by that is
not
that
every TEDx has its own bill.
And Bill came as a counter conference, one that was free to go to instead of costing a fortune.
And they had a bill up at UC Santa Cruz either last year or the year before.
Well, they had one in Monterey at the same time as the original TED, just down the street, held at the local park municipal building.
With ideas such as unconferences.
Yes, that was more of a meetup. That was an unconference where if you knew that TED was happening and you wanted to go to Bill, you would show up at the unconference and sign up for your speaker slot, and then you would give your speech to the assembled audience.
Yeah. That's right.
And of course, several people from the original TED would, the cool ones would go over to Bill and speak there as well. And Bill, you signed up. They had a big board, and you signed up what time slot you wanted to talk about, what you were into. And it was a free-for-all. And it was very interesting. They had, you know, swarm talks on cars and how, you know, the highways of the future would be swarms, things like that. Very amazing ideas were happening at Bill as well. So I think TEDx, TED, first of all, shooed Bill. And then finally they invited the organizers, you know, the guys who put Bill together to the TED conference. And then it wasn't long after that, I believe in the ideology, that TEDx came out. And TEDx was a decentralized TED where it was organized along the same principles as the primary TED in Monterey, but it was available to the local backyard geniuses all over the planet.
So now there's a TEDx Dubai, there's a TEDx London, there's a TEDx San Francisco,
right.
And
we TEDx just had Santa Cruz. We just had our first one last weekend, and it was really successful. It was really inspiring. And
oh, yes. There was twittering from the TEDx San Jose and TEDx San Francisco that the bar had been raised by TEDx Santa Cruz.
Do you think so? Do you think it really is?
That's what I heard.
Because I was hanging out with some of the serious nerds, for example, and they were bemoaning the fact there were so much feminine interests going on.
They were bemoaning?
Yeah, they were saying, well, where's the beef? Where's the real information here? They were talking about, emotion. You know, there were talks on people overcoming hardships in their life to do amazing things. I think that's more of a storyline that women like. Guys very often just go for the toys and how they work. It was
We did have one of the biggest feminists in the world speak.
That's right.
Dr. Eisner, who wrote The Chalice and the Sword.
Yeah, Rianne Eisler.
And she had very interesting things to say.
I believe in the feminine side of things. I'm not saying I believe I'm in the same camp as some of these nerds I was
Of course not, Dr. Future. I would never imply such a terrible thing. We know you love women.
Yeah, but I like guys too.
So what was your favorite? There was what, 36? How
27.
Many?
There were 27 speakers.
I think Miss Future and I really like Joe Jordan.
Yes, Joe Jordan was my favorite. He has been one of my favorite speakers for a long time, and he really did a great job at TED. He's a local professor and an astronomer, and he's a major solar advocate, and he just did a great presentation on how easy it would be if we just invested on par with non-renewable technologies, if we invested in renewable technologies. What a simple equation it is. How much more power is available than we need.
Well, one graphic really got my attention.
Was it the big cube graphic?
Yes, that is it.
I was going to mention that one too.
So, you want to describe it to the audience?
Well, you explain it.
Well, imagine a large cube, and this cube represents all of the solar energy that hits the planet every year. Right? It's a certain size cube.
Let's say it's 10 inches tall. And 10 inches wide. It's 10 by 10.
Now, let's say if you make a cube of all the energy that could be generated by gas and oil.
And that's like 1 by 1 cube.
Right. It's a little tiny cube that fits
smaller
in the corner.
Smaller than 1 by 1, yeah. It's a tiny
fraction in the corner.
And that's all the current.
How about uranium?
That's not just the current use of non-renewable
that's
resources.
All.
That's the total amount available.
That's left.
Compared to 1 year of solar availability. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And how about uranium?
Remember that was invisible. You couldn't even see it on that scale.
Way smaller than the gas and oil.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And
so it just puts things in perspective,
and
isn't it?
The other graph that goes along with that is the spending and the amount of money that's being spent on non-renewable fossil fuel energy and the amount of money spent on solar energy or green renewable energy was almost as
in the opposite direction.
The opposite direction of this giant white cube being all the money being spent by big oil and the little inch by inch cube being spent on and all the jobs that could be created in this growth, this industry.
Well, this shows you from a scientific point of view that solar is the future. It's just that there's so much more energy there that's just happening every day. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely no comparison.
Yeah, so we really need to change our mind and change our habits, and we need to do it a lot faster than we're doing it.
Yeah, and it's just the way it is right now, probably because it was easier and we didn't really think it through.
Infrastructure is a large part of it, too.
I mean, the industry is only 100 years old. It's really nothing in the geological time period.
Yeah, and how long have we had fire? You know, burning is something that makes sense to a lot of people. You have to learn something new to use solar energy.
So another person that spoke that was remarkably effective was Gina Castaneda.
Who was here, our guest last week.
She was wonderful.
She got a standing ovation. Well, everyone got a standing ovation.
She brought in the whole... Remember her show last week? She talked about her solution to gangs by having them all, as a probation officer, having them all on the same soccer team.
Yes.
Well, she brought in the entire soccer team.
In their purple uniforms.
It was tremendous.
Oh, it was so moving.
I have an idea for TEDx Santa Cruz next year.
Yeah.
Because it was too small, the venue... was too small. There was not enough people.
There were some disappointed people.
That couldn't come. That the tickets sold out. Having it at the Mello Center in Watsonville would be...
It's a bigger venue.
It's a beautiful venue. It's much bigger. And I think it would be...
The next step for
having more of a Watsonville. I mean, Gina was one of the few... Watsonville people that was representing the TEDx in Santa Cruz. There's a large...
I'd also like to let everybody know, in case they're not aware, that our very own KSCO Rebecca Costa also
spoke.
Gave an excellent speech at TEDx. And
she was talking about the re-evolution of business.
Yes. I found her to be sharing some of the ideas that I'm familiar with from her book, which I have read a little bit of, The Watchman's Rattle. And, you know, her issue was really complexity and how in the face of complexity, we need to have penetrating insights to come up with new solutions.
And to be able to do lots of solutions simultaneously instead of one at a time. Like she used the example of the BP oil spill last year, and they would have one solution, and then 20 days later, they said, oh, that didn't work. Here's another way of dealing with it. And then in 10 days later, another one said, that didn't work. Instead of one at a time like that, she said, what if the 83rd one was the one that actually worked instead of the third one? We were very lucky. It was there's got to be a better way than linear attempts at solving things.
Mm-hmm,
so
right.
She talked about parallelism and very important basic ideas like that should be implemented in the way that our governments handle issues.
Yes.
Yeah. Interdimensional thinking.
Yeah. Multidimensional thinking, too.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So, well, hey, I would love to invite any of our callers, if you have anything you'd like to say about TEDx or brilliant ideas in general that you think everybody else would like to hear, remind you that this is a talk show. Feel free to call in and talk. And if you want to do that, the number here, 831-479-1080, KSCO. Okay. So,
so we have our website. You can also listen to our show and look at the Twitters and that sort of thing at drfutureshow.com, drfutureshow.com.
Yes.
And are we doing the Sinecast, Dr. Future?
Oh, thanks for reminding me. Yeah, let me pull up the Sinecast.
Okay, I think we're going to go to a break.
Okay.
And then...
That's KSCO.com/DRFuture, and you'll be able to surf along with us.
Okay, see you after the break.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. To continue the info that we've collected this week, we also went to the Harmony Festival in Santa Rosa at the Sonoma County Fairgrounds. This Future and I had a wonderful time there. I don't know, if any of you have never been to the Harmony Festival, it's got to be one of the most amazing, magical festivals in the area.
It's exquisite. There are so many interesting people there. They have so many stages. They're very on the edge of emerging culture. They have great fashions. They have an eco community dome. They have
eco village.
Healing center. They have a goddess stage. They have a hemp movement section that was brand new this year.
Yeah, that's true. That was quite interesting. There was a number of Santa Cruz medical dispensaries with booths there. And they you had to show your medical marijuana card to get into that zone. But you could then smell different samples. You could try cannabis ice cream. You could do all the... They had a place called the Hookah Dome, which was a geodesic dome set up so people could sample the wares of various companies. I think they gave them away there.
Yeah, they had to legally. Yeah. They weren't allowed to sell anything, but they were allowed to share samples.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Future, Mrs. Future, this was at the Santa Rosa Fairgrounds?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
And then there's camping next to it.
Yeah, it's a three-day festival where you can camp, so it has a lot of the advantages, Burning Man and festivals where you sleep over, but without the inconvenience of having to be in the middle of the desert somewhere. Mm. You know, so I like that.
And we discovered some new music of Primus was kind of the main stage band the day we were there.
Yeah,
that was great.
So a huge Santa Cruz contingent there, including one of the stages. So it was Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Techno tribal, very tribal. It's I'd say that one of the biggest things in the Bay Area is the neo tribal feelings of people belonging to something more than just the neighborhood or just having friends, but having more of a tribe. And a lot of that tribal consciousness was evident at the Harmony Festival.
Yeah, yeah. There were a lot of big groups of friends that seemed to be there dancing and setting up their blankets like
hey,
they do. Yeah.
Did you meet the ticket winner, the KSCO ticket winner who got to go?
No, I didn't get to meet him. It's a guy from Maine, wasn't it?
Tom?
His phone number.
Tom's from Maine?
Tom's phone number was from Maine, but Tom lives here in Santa Cruz.
I think it was in the dentistry pavilion over there. Anyway, I hadn't met him. I'd like to.
Tom, if you're listening, we'd love to hear what you thought of the Harmony Festival.
Yeah, let us
Give
know.
Us a call.
He gave away two free tickets last weekend, folks, to people going to the Harmony Festival.
Yeah, you had to answer a question
yeah.
for the organizer.
It's a very arcane musical question, which I had no clue of.
I didn't have a clue either. But it was cool because the phones lit up. Our Santa Cruz audience are very intelligent.
Yeah, it's only about doing
people.
Games. Yeah, maybe we should do more games ourselves. Huh?
That's right. You have to ask trivia
for
questions.
For a free Dr. Future refrigerator magnet.
That's right.
With Agent Nada and Mrs. Future waving to you.
Right. Perhaps even wearing a 3D printed bikini.
Oh, yeah. Well.
A 3D printed bikini.
Well, that could be a good prize, wouldn't it?
That would be a good prize.
All right. You ladies want to bring this up. This is definitely a feminine topic. It involves the 3D printers, a very, you know, one of our new toys.
This is one of the news articles that you took off from the web. You threw your net out wide, and you bring back these amazing articles.
I did.
And this one seemed the most important to you for some reason.
Well, I'll tell you why.
At the top of the list.
I'll tell you why, Janata. It has to do with this marvelous technology, the 3D printers, where we can print anything, including organs, spare body parts.
And meat.
Yeah, or printing
steak.
Meat. Yes, yes, you can
yes,
print
but
steak.
But you can start with something much simpler.
But what's interesting is that one of the things that's beginning to sell with it is not any of these crucial life-changing events, but printing bikinis. I mean, is that where the money is in our society?
Some people would say that was crucial.
You know, fashion?
These bikinis are being sold at $90 a cup.
No, what is it? Now, to explain this 3D printer bikini.
Okay, so we have the 3D printer technology we've been marveling about over the last year on the Dr. Future show. And then at the Maker Fair, we got to see them action. And we even got to see the $1,500 version take it home and do your 3D printing in the privacy of your own home.
Exactly. And as you folks know, this is where you're printing not just stuff on paper, but you're actually printing three-dimensional objects.
You're using plastic polymers, yeah, and you're making, well,
in the home version.
These cheapy versions.
Right. The public gets plastic.
Oh, and we also saw the do-it-yourself for $300. You could build your own.
Build your own for $300?
3D printer.
Yeah.
And so the...
anything made out of plastic, any shape, any object... made out of plastic.
And so what has happened here is there's a partnership between Shapeways, which is a group, I guess, that was involved in demonstrating 3D fabrics.
Yeah, they're one of the first entrepreneurial companies that will take your orders and create a 3D object for you out of it.
And in partnership with Continuum Fashion, since last August, they have been experimenting with different 3D fabric designs to come up with something that worked as a fashion garment that you could actually print out the pieces. So you can print out the cup, and you can print out the straps, and you can print out the panties with your nylon polymer fabric. It's crafted from selective laser sintered nylon, which is called SLS.
How long before we just print out, you know, clothes for the day and then throw the old clothes in a hamper where the plastic gets recycled or materials get recycled and the dirt goes to the garden.
Yeah, holodeck, here we come.
Yeah. So what do these cost now? What does it cost to have a fashion designer 3D printed?
$200, I think.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money for some plastic.
Well, fashion is that way.
You know, I can't help but wonder, how comfortable is it?
That's a good
I like
question.
To wear cotton.
Yeah. That's true. But, you know, nylon is many, many bathing suits
right.
have been made
nylon,
of nylon. People don't
true.
Complain.
So this feels more like nylon then? Is that what you're
yes,
saying?
Yes, it's called laser-sintered nylon. Mm-hmm. Selective laser-sintered nylon.
So your printer creates nylon.
So yeah. I think this is a fascinating idea that you'd be able to just throw the clothes into some bin that has some solution that can...
Break down the
material so that you can feed it through the 3D printer again. Now, Mrs. Future, you mentioned something that caught my attention. You said something about it, as long as the material isn't denatured.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, if you cook oil, you can denature it, so then it loses its capacity to be oily, right? It can be burnt. So if you want to recycle these polymers, then you have to make sure that the second time through they have the same quality as the first time. You, like the incredible shrinkies in the Easy Bake Oven, and you know, these plastics that you would start with something that was, you know, the size of a ruler, and then it would shrink down to something the size of your thumb. And, you know,
Shrinky dinks.
Yeah. There you go. So, you know, those plastics would not be good for fashions.
You're saying they've been denatured.
They've been denatured.
I like that word. I just wanted to bring it up. It's like, oh, I have a chance to use the word denatured.
Right. Let's keep it natured.
Yeah.
Okay. So what other articles would you like to talk about here, Dr. Future?
Well, what are they? Okay. Well, I think that the printer thing is just to complete on that. It's going to print more and more types of materials as time goes on. It's going to become something that you can create almost anything from. And it's significant because it's going to bring in production back to the garage here in America, where we won't have to go to China and other places in the world anymore.
Oh,
so we decentralize production down to the micro level, down to your house.
And
I
like the idea that instead of having to go and pick up some laundry detergent at the store, you'll go pick up some polymers for your next outfit.
Yeah, you'll only have to buy a few special choice supplies for your printer, and everything else will come from your printer.
Now you know. Yeah. You know how expensive that printer ink is for our regular.
Yeah. The business to be in is creating the future goo for the 3D printers.
Yeah, yeah. I can see HP figuring out a way.
Those are the molecules that matter.
Package it in a way that makes it more precious than platinum.
Well, it's your. Well, hopefully it'll get down in cost enough so that you can afford it, or that.
Or how about just grow your little hemp in the backyard
and use that. Yeah,
make little hemp balls.
Hemp fabric.
So have it work directly on crops from your yard.
Yeah.
As the raw material.
So weed, it grows really fast.
So you can grow your printer ink.
Three times a year.
Yeah.
Well,
I think we should make fashion and money out of it so that, you know, instead of having inflation, we just burn the money as we need it.
Uh-huh. Right, right.
Then you just create new money when you need it.
Right. Out of the hemp from
grow
the backyard.
Grow your own money. And money does grow on hemp trees.
Hey, George Washington grew hemp.
Uh-huh. So did King Henry VIII.
And the energy.
He accepted taxes made of hemp.
And the energy comes from solar. Hey,
that's right.
Ah, the future's so bright. Gotta wear shades.
You ladies are definitely thinking ecosystems here.
Oh yeah, we like nature.
And I've been thinking a lot about it. We have a book we mentioned in our links regarding ecosystems, which I think is worth mentioning. And it has to do with the idea that humankind is so rapidly evolving things that can nature keep up with us? Like if we put all this carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, can nature keep up with us? And it's not just a matter of
the carbon that's in the atmosphere. It's the heating up of the earth and the melt of the glaciers and the rising of the waters and the losing of topsoil that is so problematic.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So can evolution outpace climate change?
Well, that is the question.
Where did you find this article?
Proceedings of the Royal Society.
Well, this is from UC Davis, courtesy of Amara via Kurzweil AI. And the idea is that animals and plants may not be able to evolve their way out of the threat posed by climate change, according to this new UC Davis study. And they've been studying a tiny seashore animal called the Tigreopus californicus, or corpod, and they've been looking at its ability to increase its heat tolerance, you know, and as things get warmer, how fast can its little biological body keep up with the rising temperatures? And they're beginning to see that even though these guys are very, very versatile in their ability to handle change, they're not quite as versatile as the changes that are occurring. So this does not speak well for biology keeping up with industrial pollution and things like that. Mm-hmm. However, I don't think he's looking at the whole evidence. I think the fact that we have worms at Chernobyl and fungal networks at Chernobyl, as well as...
They have a nature preserve now at Chernobyl.
Right.
Because nobody human hasn't gone in there.
He's messed around with the ecosystem.
And so there's many sightings of animals that had been completely gone from the region, like certain foxes and, of course, the deer population. And so it's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I think nature will adapt. We might not survive. A lot of species might not survive, given...
I think our species is very likely to be one of the ones that does survive. I think it's really how many of the other species can we keep with us while we wake up. That's really the big issue. Mm-hmm. So can humanity keep the rest of the species alive? That's really the game.
So, Dr. Future, I was telling you I'm reading a book right now called The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution by Richard Dawkins. Mm-hmm. And he would possibly argue against this theory that UC Davis is putting out with using this core pod as evidence.
What do you think he would say?
Well, he has a chapter that he cites the rapid change in the African elephant, mm-hmm. and the
tusk shift,
the tusks going over a 100-year period. These animals are growing lighter tusks, and why is that? Well, it's in reaction to the hunting that began from 200 years ago for the ivory of the tusks, mm-hmm. and so the animals. Now, how did this happen? How was it the animals that survived had smaller tusks because they hadn't been hunted, and so they're passing on the smaller tusk gene? Has there been a mutation that's happened? I'm not sure. But the fact of the matter is that elephants have reacted very quickly on an evolutionary scale, talking usually of millions of years.
In 100 years, you're talking
about. In 100 years.
And even faster, we were talking about the earthworms at Chernobyl.
That's right.
Who have adapted to radiation conditions. So nature does understand short time periods in evolution, as well as long ones.
That's right.
It just might not be our species that adapts this. Of course, you're saying, son, that yes, we will be the ones that survive. I suppose that's possible if we reach the point of being conscious enough of the changes to be able to adapt our genome. We're able to manipulate the genome now
to
adapt to change.
I believe that humanity was created by nature, mm-hmm. to help during this time of climate shift, and that we'll be able to rise to that occasion. We also have a caller who's coming in. So maybe in our last minute, why don't we quickly say hello to the caller just before the break?
Okay.
Okay. Here we go. Okay. Hello, caller.
Hi there.
There we go.
Is your name Brock?
Yes, this is Brock. I'm one of your fans.
Hi, Brock.
Hi, Brock.
I was listening to several of your comments, and they all sort of wove together into the future. Mm-hmm. The sun itself is often ignored as either a source of pollution or beneficent. People that I know that deal in, my students and others that deal in asteroid exploration uses future, they basically say you're going to have 8 feet thick steel between you and the sun so your eggs don't turn out funny. We've given several Freedom Awards to astronauts that stayed up there longer than 177 days. Or their kids would turn out looking funny.
These bodies aren't exactly...
Human evolution in space is going to be us living in giant steel beach balls.
It's dicey. We need to seriously manipulate the genome for space, that's for sure.
That would be possible. Mm-hmm. A lot of people that are so-called handicapped on Earth may find great advantages in low G.
Yeah, hey, Willie, you have 30 seconds. Would you like to make a point on this?
One other thing is, I'd like you guys to Google Milankovitch cycles, where Earth's orbit is a little elliptical and it oscillates.
Uh-huh. Let's do that right after the break, okay, Brock?
Okay, well, hold on.
Hang on, and we'll be right back.
Talk about the Milankovitch cycles.
Standing by?
Yeah, we're back, Brock. So do you want to complete your point there?
Yeah. I was teaching physical science about the year 2000 and mm-hmm. was noticing a lot of glaciers disappearing and things like the Aral Sea drying up.
Yeah.
And I got curious as to why, and I'm more of a space cadet as opposed to landlubber. And so I started looking at astronomical causes, and I quickly found that a Serbo-Croatian scientist named Milankovic, M-I-L-A-N-K-O-V-I-T-C-H, had come up with a theory in the 30s that Earth's orbit isn't perfectly round like in some Aristotelian...
I mean, the elliptical orbit, which would affect climate change.
And when you combine that oscillation with certain seasons, like you're closer to the sun during the summer and winter, you get a really heat-up effect that lasts for about 17 years. And then the Earth's orbit begins to round out again, and then it oscillates into some other shape, say spring and fall.
Hmm.
And all through this time, climate change happens big time, and there's not as much heat as humans could manufacture as being a little closer to the sun slightly.
Oh, good. Well, that's a very interesting reference. I appreciate that. What was his name again? Milankovic?
Is that
Milankovic.
Okay.
The consequences of this for thinking about pollution and so forth is we can make a lot of wrong decisions if we start blaming the wrong causes on the wrong thing when all you got to do is look up at the sun.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
I can see that. Yeah, well, thank you. Appreciate that. Listen, we have a special story we want to share with you at this point with a special guest on. So I appreciate your comment, and thanks for listening.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thanks, Brock.
Okay,
have a good day.
Mm-hmm. Will do. Bye. Okay, Sunny. Bring up our special guest. We have Deborah Arturo on. Father's Day, as you know, is coming up on Sunday. And this was a story that I heard from Deborah of a special thing that she did with her dad. For not for Father's Day, but just because we'll let her tell you. Deborah, are you there?
I am.
All right. All right, good. Now, you... your father doesn't live around here, right? And you brought him out here for a very special occasion. Can you tell us about what happened?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thanks. My father and I were estranged for many years. I didn't have the quintessential happy childhood or relationship with my father. And
so when you left home, that was it? You just didn't communicate for a while?
Actually, at about 12, my father and I stopped communicating, and I saw him once when I was 18, once again when I was 22. Maybe we talked a dozen times over those 20-ish years.
Wow.
And we'd been in communication over the last 5 years, a little bit, and I'd done a bunch of healing work and personal growth, and I had an experience that brought to mind the question, what would I regret if I didn't do or say it in this life, and where am I not complete? And my father came to mind, and I thought to myself, if I did not spend time with my father before he died, I would always regret that. And I'm committed to not consciously regretting things.
Yeah. You don't want to have to. If I only had talked to my father one more time,
right,
or something like that. Yeah.
If I'd only listened to that little voice in my head that said, go see him or spend some time with him.
Really? Is that the message? You got to spend some time with him?
Spend some time with my dad. Yes.
Well, so what did you do?
So I called him,
yeah?
And I said, and he doesn't have a lot of money, and I was really committed to seeing him and spending time, so I said, hey, Dad, I really want to spend some time with you. I'm wondering if you're interested in coming to California in 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And he, of course, said nothing.
Must have been shocked.
I imagine there was a pretty deep course of shock and awe that coursed through him, and he doesn't work, and there's nothing on his calendar, per se, that would keep him from coming. But I said, why don't you check your calendar and talk to your wife and see if anything comes up and give me a call back. Let me know.
Yeah.
And he called back and said, you know, teary-eyed and crying, of course, I want to come see you.
And,
and so the whole time I was having this conversation with him, I kept noticing this feeling that was like I was granting a wish for a Make-A-Wish Foundation or the Jacob's Heart Foundation. There was some sense of wish fulfillment that I couldn't quite put my finger on, but it was very persistent.
So you kind of sense that maybe your dad wanted to see you too?
Yeah, I'm sure that underneath the surface was that, but it was even deeper than that. It was like I was fulfilling a dying wish beyond just father-daughter.
Huh.
And so when I picked him up from the airport, I got to have this experience of being seen and witnessed with this level of awe and appreciation, and you know, to have my father standing on the curb at the airport and look at me when I got out of the car to pick him up, and this like recognition of the full embodiment of me as woman, as opposed to, you know, little girl that I was the last time I'd seen him.
And that was the image that he had of you, and I guess you of him and him of you.
Yeah, there was definitely a...
Now, how estranged was your relationship? I mean, what was it a deep issue? Or?
Well, he'd been an alcoholic, and things had been very ugly in our childhood, and there was no foundation of intimacy or connection that we had to be in this current incarnation of relationship based on. We really didn't have a past that was one that was going to bear healthy fruit.
Wow.
So... for me, this was, if we're going to have a relationship, we need to have an experience that we can base a present time relationship and grow from there.
So you were able to forgive him for his abuses?
Give thanks for the thousands of dollars of therapy and personal growth work and how many pillows I've beaten and, all of the ways that we as individuals get to move energy that's just ours that needs to be moved. And now I can... bless him for all the ways in which he served me as a soul, and I fully appreciate who he was to me in my life as a teacher. And
so what did you do when you came out here?
So he came out, and I had the thought that I wanted to take him to Pebble Beach and Big Sur and take him down 17 Mile Drive, and just there's a it was again that feeling of like the Make-A-Wish fulfillment feeling was kind of guiding the places that I was drawn to.
He was a golfer, I gather?
He loves golf. I wouldn't call him a golfer, but I would say he was a
Pebble Beach must have been
a fan of golf. And
a fantasy of his. Like.
Yeah, he's definitely a golf watcher in Ohio. And but he's also not a man who walks with any real sense of self-authority or self-esteem. So he wouldn't be presumptuous enough to feel welcome at Pebble Beach.
Or he was more like a blue-collar worker kind of guy?
He just didn't have a lot of self-esteem and a lot of sense of self-worth.
Didn't feel like he belonged there. It was
didn't feel like he belonged.
Above his station in life.
Right, yeah. And so when I said to him I wanted to take him to these places, his eyes lit up and I got this, I've always wanted to go there, and since I was 11 years old, I've been dreaming about Big Sur, and Kim Novak lived in Big Sur, and I love Jane Steinbeck, and I've always wanted to go there. And it was literally the fulfillment of his 63 years old. He was on the verge, actually part of the poignancy was that he was on the verge of turning 63, which was the age his father was when he died.
Oh, wow.
So there was this double-edged poignancy, which was, since he was 11 years old, he'd been dreaming about these places, never even conceived that he would actually get there. Yeah. And contemplating his own mortality simultaneously.
And you talked to him about all these things?
Oh, yeah. We had the capacity to really have deep, intimate conversation. And one of the things that was wonderful about the experience was that he and I had a similar vision. We were driving through these immaculately, incredibly beautiful places, I would stop and say, oh, and he'd go, oh, and we would both turn in the same direction to kind of frame the view of natural beauty in the same way.
Wow.
And so we had this wonderful mutual awe of nature that was in the particular.
Can you give me an example?
There was a moment as we were driving down from Pacific Grove. There's a small patch of grass with a couple of trees and an opening over the grass out where you can see out to the ocean. And there happened to be a sailboat just in that perfect window between the two branches of the trees, over the grass, with the birds on the lawn. And we both simultaneously stopped and went, look, in this, from the same vantage point, with the same real bliss and joy in our bodies. And to have the moment personally is one thing, but to share it with another is always lovely. But to share it with another who's having the same experience of joy in the same moment.
Yeah.
And to have this wonderful experience with this man who I didn't really have not one single conscious pleasant memory with.
As a father.
As a father was extraordinary as a daughter and as a being who had long felt artistic and connected to nature in ways that weren't the way that my mother experienced and perceived nature and beauty. And she wasn't touched by life the same way I was. And I always had this feeling of being a little bit like an orphan.
Hmm. And but now you know that it is your dad that you maybe got some of that sense, that kind of wave of expressing appreciation from.
Very much so. Like, I am my father's daughter.
Yeah. And you both saw that in that moment.
We did.
We had,
and there's a, somebody took a photograph of us standing at, there's a, the lone cypress, classic image.
The archetype of.
Right, of the Monterey Peninsula that has long been one of his favorite kind of visual nature highlights. And so there's this photograph of he and I standing with the lone cypress behind us, and it's truly one of the calmest, most peaceful, happy expressions of a being that I've ever inhabited. It's a wonderful reminder of, for him, this dream fulfilled, time with his daughter, my experience of I am my father's daughter, and from this place of connection, we have a place to move from.
Right? Yeah.
Deborah, I have a couple of questions
for
you. You know, I'm wondering what it was that helped you realize that it was an appropriate time to reach out for your father, and also if there is any connection, like in terms of advice that you would give people for Father's Day this year, you know, in terms of honoring your father.
You know, rooted in it was, rooted in the choice to connect with him was my deep commitment to myself. To live true to my heart and caring for myself. And caring for myself meant connecting with him right here, right now, and not delaying the opportunity to connect and be in relationship with him.
So you had no cues from him at all. This was really a personal process that helped you to claim something beautiful from what otherwise might have been a tragic experience.
Truly,
with your father.
Truly, the internal sense of I want to be liberated from anything that I can consciously free myself from, and the fact that I got to gift my father the experience of coming and being with me and experiencing not only relating with me, but he and my brother had been estranged for as long as my father and I had been. And he and my father hadn't even spoken. And I was able to graciously invite my brother to join us all for brunch and to choose to embody forgiveness, that forgiveness is something I do for me, that my brother could choose to forgive the past for himself, not for my father, but to choose to forgive the man. That the actions themselves may not be forgivable, but the man gets to be loved and honored and blessed for being a human. And so I felt like that was really the jewel of the teaching for all of us as a family, that the greatest gift we have to offer our intimate relations is to forgive the human that we're in relationship with, and to love ourselves enough to forgive him for our sake.
Did he ever express a sorrow to you for what happened?
He has expressed his sorrow in his willingness to hold space for my process. There hasn't been a lot of admittance on his part. He's talked about how challenging it was to be in relationship with my mother and their dynamic and the...
So it's moved your whole emotional literacy forward with your with him and...
With him, for certain.
Yeah.
I have a deep appreciation for his willingness to be an empathetic listener, because I'm willing to come to the conversation from a place of 100% responsibility for Dad, I'm sad. I'm really sad that I had this experience, and I feel angry that I didn't get to have this as a little girl, and I'm sad, and he can say, wow, I hear that you're sad.
Yeah.
And not try to fix it now.
Yeah.
Nothing to fix.
Yeah. And you're still in communication today, to this day. Huh?
And we have a very magical, actually, a very magical connection.
Good. Well, that's taking the initiative, Father's Day, yeah, out there. If any of you have issues with your brother, or your father, especially father in this case, think about this. This is a real story in our community.
Yeah.
Someone who has dealt with this issue and with great results.
Deborah, thank you so much
beautiful
for giving us
Father's Day story, Deborah.
Yeah, thank
beautiful
you.
Song.
My pleasure. I bless all relationships with fathers and daughters and fathers and sons and between mothers and fathers. Bright blessings on fathers.
KSEO Santa Cruz.
Thank you. Deborah Arturo.
Stay tuned.
For the Dr. Future Show, we'll see you after the break with the Surviving the Future.
As we return to what's left in Dr. Future on AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Dr. Future Show. We have a very special hour of conversation for you guys today and ladies out there. We have Richard Ely on, who is... Well, Richard is a very interesting fellow. He's not only a professional geologist, but he's also a longtime initiate of various neo-pagan, earth-based religious traditions. And he combines his scientific and his poetic spirituality in a very stimulating way, which I think you'll enjoy. And with him, we have Julia Bastrova. Julia... Now, if you go to her LinkedIn page, you can see that she's very much a wellness trainer in helping to heal people in various methods of transformation. We could go into some depth about that at some future point. But what her wider background is about science and spirituality and the relationship between science and spirituality. And also, let's say in this case, we are going to be focusing on civilization-ending events, real geology, real things that might affect us all. Richard's going to tell us about, and Julia's going to give us a little insights about what we can do about it and how we can handle those situations.
And I'd just like to add before we bring them on that one of Julia's interests and active areas is that she works with the Transitions Movement, where I know a lot of people here are involved with Transitions Santa Cruz. Well, Julia is with Transitions in Sebastopol. So we're going to get some survival tips and some clues as to what our neighbors in Sebastopol are doing. So welcome, Richard. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you.
Good. Welcome to the show. Now, Richard, what really should we worry about? We hear about all these crazy things like pole shifts and massive tsunamis and earthquakes and asteroids and all. Give us a menu of what we should really pay attention to from your point of view.
Well, from my point of view, the biggie is a mega volcano.
Mega volcano.
Like Yellowstone.
The caldera of Yellowstone.
Thousands of cubic miles of ash.
Can you tell us what that is exactly and why it's so?
Well. There are a number of them in North America. There's Yellowstone. There's a long valley near Mono Lake, just east of Yosemite.
Really close.
And then there's one at Taos, or not near Taos, the big one. Oh, the Valles Caldera. That's a huge one also. Any one of those, if it went, would be... We'd have no summer for several years.
I mean, the sun would just go away. It would be like
winter. The depression, the sulfuric acid, and everything else that would be erupted into the atmosphere would cause massive global cooling. And there'd be massive crop failures, and there's no cushion anymore. We don't have the bulging food banks that we used to have when I was young, surplus grain and all that sort of thing.
So we're caught with our pants down.
Yeah, we're basically just in time with the food. And I've seen a number of people that suggesting we're at peak food because of, you know, depletion of groundwater, erosion of topsoil, all the abuses of mechanized farming.
Wow.
So that one of those eruptions would pretty much take out a substantial percentage.
Now, is that something that could happen soon?
Yes. I mean,
what's the time frame on that?
What's your sense?
That's the problem, see.
We don't really know.
Yeah, but the bad actors are actually in Indonesia.
The ones that are acting up now.
Krakatoa. Mm-hmm. Or a ball is out there. I forget which archipelago it's in, but it was fought over during the Second World War. It's a huge circular harbor that's the caldera proper. Ball has been stirring, and that could create global climate catastrophe.
And don't forget about Iceland.
Iceland, yeah. What is it? The the Laki volcano. Yeah, that was 1873, and that blanketed Europe in an acid fog of sulfuric acid and also hydrofluoric acid, which was really, really hard on the Icelandic population, the fluoridosis.
Wow.
It killed much of their livestock. 25% of the population died. Benjamin Franklin observed it when he was ambassador over there. And Europe was blanked with it, with this dry fog that caused massive crop failures. But that was like Northern Hemisphere. But again, you know, if you have massive crop failures in the Northern Hemisphere, that's where most of the food is.
Okay.
But the land is, and it's just, we don't have any cushion. We don't have any slack.
And there's no prediction as to when these might happen. They could happen tomorrow. They could happen 100 years from now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But they will happen.
So given this kind of, you know,
geological
time,
spectrum,
what can you do? I mean, what can we do about this other than worry about it?
I think there are just too many of us, and it really ought to be, and this is so politically incorrect, but there ought to be an anti-natalist policy, you know, that we encourage people to have, like the Chinese have been doing, fewer children and gradually draw down the global population to a billion or so.
Well, it's from what you're saying, it sounds like if we don't, the planet will do it for us.
And then Mama will do it to us, yeah. Mm-hmm. Question.
Yeah.
Huh. You know, the timing on Yellowstone, for example, is roughly every 600,000-700,000 years, and it's been 600 since the last one. But, you know, we would get lots of warning at Yellowstone.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of sensors there too, right?
Events, but
yeah, I would imagine Yellowstone's probably one of the most observed of such potentially catastrophic
events.
Yeah,
anything in North America is thoroughly observed, at least under present budgetary situations. But certain people don't think we need to be monitoring volcanoes. The governor of Louisiana.
So let me just reiterate what you're saying, Richard, is that you think our current geological primary concerns are from volcanoes as opposed to pole shifts.
Well, it's just the starting point.
Climate change through global warming or any of those other concerns.
Well, it would go against the warming. It would be a massive cooling event that would last for several years when you have one of these mega volcanoes go. And I don't know who's looking at the Indonesian ones, but Indonesia's got some serious bad actors over there. I mean, Krakatoa, a repeat of Krakatoa would cause massive crop failures as well.
Is this where it's a good idea to have your grow lights and hydroponics growing tomatoes as well as other crops? Or what? What's the solution to this? Any ideas? Julia, have you thought about this?
Yeah. Well, this is the thing that transition is all about, although we don't talk about volcanoes very much, but we do talk about the fact that people need to think about how to prepare for the future, and the future right now is very uncertain. I think pretty much most people agree about that.
So growing your own garden?
Yeah. You have the real grassroots movement to get people to be growing more of their own food, mm-hmm. and localizing food, you know, local farms, CSAs, really becoming, getting more localized with what we're buying in general as well as food, so that we can be more sustainable. And then also just, you know, learning what your local community can do, what your resources are, who's out there that you can connect with.
What do you think is the most effective thing that you personally are doing in your efforts to be sustainable in the event of some kind of unforeseeable catastrophe?
Okay, well, because we don't know what's going to happen, we can't live in fear, first of all. We need to educate ourselves, yes, but there's only so much time and energy any one of us have to spend educating ourselves about what's out there. I recommend that we try to stay up on as much as we can, especially we're going to do that in our interest area. Mm-hmm. Richards is obviously in geology, and he knows a lot about that. And there's other people that are looking at the economy, and they have a lot to say about that. So there's so many categories right now of things that are so unstable and uncertain.
What about Richards' contention that we should reduce population? You think?
Well, there are a lot of people that have very strong opinions about that. And at the way that we are living now, I agree. Actually, mm-hmm. However, if we were living radically differently, mm-hmm. I don't know if that, I said that right,
if we
were really simplified, downsized, living, you know, much more sustainably, then, you know, perhaps we could sustain this level of population. I don't know.
Well, what does sustainably mean?
Less
what
electricity?
Does sustainable living look like?
Smaller cars?
Yeah, shared transportation. Getting off of fossil fuel is one of the big ones that most people are looking at. How do we, you know, what are the alternative energy?
Solar panels?
Yeah, solar
drive
panels.
Drive less?
You know, you've got biodiesel, wind power. You've got a number of other options that people are looking at.
Telecommuting?
Yeah, telecommuting.
What about just staying home all the time?
Well, you know, you also want to be, you want to have a life, you know, you don't want to stay home all the time.
Well, that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, you want to find ways to get out, but ways that work. I mean, flying around is also something we have to think about, you know.
Flying takes up a huge amount of energy from my understanding.
So, you know, if you look at other economies like Scandinavia, I mean, they have a high standard of living on about half the per capita energy consumption that Americans do.
Well, they're a smaller country, right?
It uses a lot less energy per capita than the rest of the country, thanks to Jerry Brown in his first administration when he put in all those appliance standards and similar rules, regulations that have, you know, built up a long-term
I mean, like Energy Star ratings on your refrigerator?
Yeah, that kind of thing. It's astonishing how much more efficient the common home appliances are than they used to be.
So you like the environmental regulations for energy efficiency. You think that's a step in the right direction?
I think you should be able to buy all the stupid crap you want, but there ought to be an economic penalty. And that would drive it in the way of efficiency.
So rich people should be able to waste power, but everybody else should be legally constrained to be efficient.
No, I think there ought to be junky stuff taxes. Would be say you've got a really wasteful refrigerator, there ought to be and that refrigerator costs $20 less to produce. Okay. Well, there ought to be like $100 tax on that, some kind of penalty that makes the energy hog more expensive than the economic one. Uh-huh. Like with light bulbs, you know, these people are all tweaked over giving up incandescent bulbs. Well, put a tax on them, and you can have all the incandescent ones you want. Just pay extra.
Great. Well, listen, we just got a caller who'd like to join in on our conversation.
You guys ready
here,
for a question
so
from the audience?
Are you guys up for that?
Yeah, and at some point I would like to answer your question more on what I'm doing to prepare because that was more of a general answer. But we can.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, we'll do that right after.
We'll do that right after we pick up our call here. Okay, so let's see. Hello, caller. Are you there? Let me see.
Sun is just picked up the board from Nada.
And I'm not sure exactly what I'm doing. Hello. Is that a caller for the Dr. Future show? No. All right. You know what? It's your turn to just answer your question, Julia, because there was nobody there, so I'm not quite sure.
The ghost caller.
Yes. Caller, if I inadvertently cut you off without hearing you, you can feel free to call back.
Sun is just learning the board, and please call back.
Yes, I'm here at KSEO 479-1080, and we would love for you to join our conversation about how to survive the future. Okay.
Okay, go ahead, Julia.
Tell us, Julia.
Yeah, I just really wanted to emphasize about not living in fear. Mm-hmm. The thing that, and educating ourselves, I mean, yes, we can do all these things, and we need to do all these things as a society to become more sustainable and to become more aware of what we're doing and the impact on the planet. And I think, you know, more and more that's being accepted. But what I'm about, what I've spent time working with people around is how our spiritual and our psychological being needs to prepare.
Well, give me an example, Julia. What would disturb someone who, you know, need, you know, enough so that they'd change their spirituality?
What can disturb them?
Like running out of money.
Well, sure, and those things are happening a lot right now. You know, we hear stories about people that are losing their homes and their mm-hmm. jobs and committing suicide. For instance. Mm-hmm.
So just feeling hopeless about
hopeless, don't see any way to go, and this is actually unfortunately becoming more and more common, depending on you know where you live, of course. But this is very sad. And what if these people, often the ones that are committing suicide, are going into some kind of mental breakdown? Are people that have relied on the structures that they've been gotten used to. They've had a regular job. They've had a regular income. They've had whatever they've had.
You've had a family, and suddenly you're divorced, and you're by yourself in an apartment.
Right, and they
not sharing about your future.
Right, and they lose that. They don't have any inner what we call inner resiliency. Mm-hmm. And inner resiliency is built up by having, getting connected into a deeper part of yourself where you have resources. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not talking about religious, although that can be. And actually, you find a lot of people who are involved in a church or a community, a spiritual community.
Well, that's when often people get religious is when they have to go through some major life change.
Exactly. And people that are already involved in a spiritual community often find that community will support them.
Well, that's it. That's one of the reasons why you'd adopt the different spiritual communities, because they provide a community, a sense of belonging to something bigger than yourself.
And when you have a connection like those that believe in God and or something divine and other than themselves, that gives them incredible solace in times of crisis. I mean, it really gets people through. So what about those people that don't have that? What are those people that aren't living that way? What do they have to lean on? And so, you know, it's building inner resiliency is I think crucial for this time right now, along with all the external resilience things that we need to do, you know, that we just talked about. But the inner resiliency is absolutely vital, and it needs to be just as much part of the conversation, in my opinion.
Okay, is there anything?
Let's bring Robert from Santa Cruz in on the conversation. Okay, Robert, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
All right.
We can hear you.
Hi.
Welcome
thank
to
you.
The show.
Thank you for taking my call. View to the future, yes?
Yes.
Indeed.
Concerning the environmental situation, which is so important to all of us now, and the sources of energy, it was just announced this morning that the Sierra Club declined in participating in ethanol energy derived from corn. And what they did is what all the other scientists have done for so long now, is realizing that it takes too much oil products
to grow corn,
that amount of corn to bring it down to ethanol that can be put in, mixed into gasoline.
Oh, the,
It's expensive biofuel. Like, there are better ways to do it.
Yeah, there was one of the TED Talks.
And then what was brought up let's say, for example, in Cuba and other areas where they grow vast amounts of sugar, the sugar has a better BTU and can be produced much cheaper, but the powers that be, Pelosi and Feinstein, in the office administrations, vetoed and put an added tax on any sugar biofuels that would be imported into the United States, therefore making the corn
more viable. Yeah.
Right.
Very
economically.
Interesting.
So, and the hypocrisy of it is...
a lot of political manipulation going on there.
Yes.
Yeah.
It all boils down to politics. I'll hang up and I'm on your rebuttal on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robert.
You know, it's ironic that the boycott that we've instituted over Cuba all these decades has forced them to be resourceful and not so dependent on the full catastrophe of late 20th century technology, that they've got a lot of resources that they've had to do for sheer survival's sake.
Okay. You know, we're getting ready to take a short break here, so I think let's think about discussing some of that after the break. So could you just say that one more time, Richard? We want to think about our resources.
Yeah, I think there's not enough. We're eating the seed corn on a planetary basis.
Okay, after the break on Dr. Future Show. Thanks.
I think there are better ways to look at these things. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. You guys want to finish any thoughts on the last comment before we move on to some other topics?
Well, I have my personal nightmare scenario is not a volcano.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small-scale nuclear war that is designed to take out the electronic infrastructure. You know, about electromagnetic pulse.
EMP pulse weapons.
EMP pulse. The North Koreans could pop a nuke 100 miles over Southern California, and it would, every electronic instrument, every car, every elevator, every computer, everything would die.
Yeah, I understand we launched some kind of weapons along those lines on Iraq when we took over Baghdad. There were ways of taking out the power grid, for example, very quickly.
Yeah.
But I probably don't think it was an EMP pulse. That was more like fiction, like 24, where they have EMP pulse weapons, controlled by terrorists. But you think that's a viable issue that just might happen?
Yeah. You know, when they did those Bikini Atoll tests back in around 1950 or thereabouts, and they did I think it was the first hydrogen bombs. They lost their electronics on a number of the Navy ships, and they weren't ready for it. They didn't realize that this was going to happen.
That's what they call hardened technology.
Well, they've hardened the military stuff, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But the rest of us
would go out.
Ooh, our cars don't drive. Our phones don't work. Nothing. It all. We don't have electricity.
So much for our backup emergency plans, huh?
What comes to mind there is those of us that have lived in an analog world where we really didn't carry our computers everywhere with us and didn't use GPS to find locations might have an advantage.
Exactly, yeah.
You know? So you say with...
But that would produce catastrophic social breakdown. And that's easily done by North Korea, Pakistan, India, any of those small-scale nuclear countries could do it.
Hmm. Would it knock out economic systems too?
Well, you go figure. If nothing, if no engine is running, There's no electric power for 10 million people.
How long does it last? Does it fry the equipment?
You repair everything.
You have to repair everything.
Everything.
Uh-huh. Now, are these type of weapons cheap and readily available, or are they still really expensive?
It's just a thermonuclear weapon.
Okay, so
any weapon would do it.
I'm curious what the repair would look like, because it seems like that's a very good thing to have in your survival kit. Is, you know, if you really feel that's a viable threat, how would you personally be prepared to recover?
Well, you could have a Faraday cage, I suppose, but, you know.
No.
The whole infrastructure. I mean, you got to walk everywhere. How's the food going to come in? How's the tractors? I mean, the whole California aqueduct system would cease to function. It would. That'd be it. Oh, here's another one. I totally forgot. It's the Arc Storm, they're calling it.
The Arch Storm?
It's a repeat of
Richard,
winter
what do you
of 1862-63 when the whole Central Valley flooded.
A flood.
And they have modeled this. And
caused by what? What causes the flood?
A 2-month Pineapple Express. You know, when we have the tropical air coming into California, we've looked. The geology community has looked at the records of storm events, and they have found that these so-called arc storms occur roughly every 200 years.
Hmm.
Now, what happens when the whole Central Valley floods? We're talking Bakersfield, Fresno, Sacramento, gone, underwater.
For how long?
For months.
So it makes Katrina look like.
They were boating cross-country from Sacramento to the Bay Area just in 1863, that spring.
100 years ago. So we're halfway through the predictive cycle there.
It's not a clock, you know.
I see. So it could happen tomorrow, but on the average, 200
more
years.
More extreme weather events. I mean, people say global warming. I say global climate instability, because the oceans are warmer. It's just driving everything into a more extreme mode. So you get the bigger hurricanes in the Gulf, and are we going to get more tropical rain in California? We got a lot of rain this year. I don't know what that was all about, but I got over 60 inches in my rain gauge.
But aren't we in a relatively stable period in geologic history? I mean, isn't this been...
We have been in a golden time.
Yeah. Yeah, since, I don't know, is it 10, 15,000 years
so
now?
So it
the end
seems
of the last
to me...
stage. There have been some perturbations. You know, I just watched a show... last night on the end of the Old Kingdom in Egypt, and it's pretty clear that there was a massive drought several decades when the Nile floods failed, and there was a complete breakdown of Egyptian civilization for 200 years. And, you know, now they have the Aswan Dam that would ameliorate that, but still, I mean, these things happen.
And we're barely prepared for any of this.
We're going under the assumptions that it's going to be more or less like it has been for the last 10, 20, 30, 50 years. But that is not the way the world works. They're always large excursions, and they're not clock-like. You can't predict them.
Now you're mentioning something about 1858 when I spoke to you last about it.
Oh, that's the solar flare that.
That took out electronics then, too, didn't it? What we had.
The telegraph net. And it produced the aurora was, well, the more incoming, the bigger the aurora is. And you know, if you've ever seen a satellite photo of the auroras, it's a ring around the magnetic pole.
The aurora borealis, the northern
aurora,
lights.
And the australis as well.
Uh-huh.
And that year, they had the aurora down in the Caribbean.
Really?
Damn.
Caribbean Aurora Borealis.
Incoming. And so what are we – that could – well, I wouldn't want to be in the space station when that came in. And it – I think a lot of our – a lot of the power grid would be extremely vulnerable. And it can't be repaired, but does PG&E, do all the power companies have a huge bank of spare transformers sitting around? I think not.
Well,
go ahead, Julia.
It may not blow out the the transformers, it apparently just takes things down for a while, and then things kind of come back up. But I guess it depends on how active that solar flares are. But we do have cycles of solar activity, and I know a lot of people associate this cycle that we're in with the 2012, you know, predictions that, you know, that it's going to just take everything out. Pick your doomsday scenario. It's like that's just another one.
Well, that's the other thing that comes to mind is that, you know, what's real and what's a geomyth?
Yeah. Well, the solar thing is not a geomyth. Well-studied phenomenon. It's a predictable activity of the sun. So the reason why we're more vulnerable now is because we have more electronics happening, more of more satellites up and so on and so forth since the last cycle. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily more activity, as some people say, is happening. My brother is actually a satellite. He studies this. He's a satellite engineer. That's how I got my information.
Yeah. But what about a spiritual approach to this? I mean,
this is why I keep coming back to the spiritual, because actually Richard and I used to run a salon called Science and Spirit, and we did have one of his salons was focusing on the end of the world scenario. So we were looking at all these different doomsday. Plus, I had a show on doomsday. So all of the scenarios. I mean, there's you pick anyone, and for me, that's why I keep coming back to the spiritual, because if I, and also of course the simple living and the practical things, really practical, tangible, applicable things that you can do. I'm not talking about out there woo-woo new age, you know, people, you know, give a kind of a bad rap about new age sometimes, and maybe sometimes I might sound that way, but really everything I do is very, very practical, and that's about your health. You know, if you don't have your health, it doesn't matter, none of this else matters. If you don't have your health, if you don't feel good in your body, you're not taking care of yourself, you know, ultimately if the shit hits the fan, so the I don't know if I can say that on the air.
No, you can't really, but
I'm sorry.
You did, so okay, keep going.
Anyway, you know.
We're going to cut you off here for a minute here because it's a commercial break, not because of what you said.
Okay.
Yeah, and also I think let's really focus on real live group-centric solutions when there's massive dislocation because of unexpected climate change.
Yeah, and our station is supposed to be here for emergencies. That's one of our FEMA. Yeah.
Okay, after the break on Dr. Future Show. We'll talk to you then.
It's a beautiful thing to advertise with Dr. Future. It makes you feel so good. You'll be so happy.
For a little extra, Agent Nottle will read your text.
I will speak for you. I will say it with sexy Slavic accent.
Make your ordinary message extraordinary.
Advertise with Dr. Future.
DrFutureShow.com.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show with guests Richard Ely and Julia Bastrova. We're talking about earth changes, and one of the things that's come up recently in our stories has been the idea that can evolution outpace climate change? Can we change fast enough for any of these things to happen? Will we survive? Any thoughts on that?
Julia and Richard,
are you up there?
Can you hear us? Hello? Julia and Richard, just one second here. Okay, Julia and Richard, can you hear us?
I hear you now.
Okay, good. Yeah, son's just learning the board, so we're getting there. See, one of the big studies that just came out this week is a UC Davis study of seashore animals, and it looks like their evidence is that there are a lot of species that are really at the breaking point in their ability to evolve fast enough to survive. And what do we do about that? I mean, with all these unknown variables, can we save ourselves even? Are you optimistic about this?
I mean, only if we spiritually evolve. I feel.
Okay, well, let's get into that. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, okay, there's all this talk about, you know, consciousness and the evolution of consciousness, and, you know, there's a variety of opinions and angles about that. But really what it means for me is, and what it means as it applies to this topic is that we learn, I mean, it's the old cliche, right, that we learn to live in peace with each other. We learn to be more loving. We learn to, you know, find other ways of dealing with things.
So being loving and cooperative is the answer.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, that's a good point.
It's
competitive would just make us lose with
exactly.
This. Uh-huh, we won't be able to figure it out.
See, we're all in this together, and the more we pull together and cooperate and help each other out, I mean, any kind of road warrior future, that's it. You know,
mm-hmm.
It works.
Yeah.
It's over, right?
Yeah, and I often tell people that, you know, there's these survivalists that are piling up their guns and ammunition along with all their food and everything. And
that's,
you know,
just not going to go anywhere.
Personally, I wouldn't want to survive in a world where those are the kind of people that are left.
The Mad Max world is not for you. Okay, well, listen, we have a caller. Can you bring it on, caller, son?
Yes, I believe I can do that.
Hi, you're on Dr. Future Show.
We have Julius in Los Angeles who wants to talk a little about global warming.
What do you got for us, Julius?
Hey, I love those names, Mr. and Mrs. Future.
You know? Thanks.
I'm all about the future because I hate the now, you know.
Yeah, we have to escape somewhere, huh?
Right on. I'm trying to build a time machine to get to the future because this world's effed up beyond recognition, right? But sometimes I feel like I was born way ahead of my time, you know, because of my intelligence.
Uh-huh.
It's like this world is so painful to me because I see how it could be, right, if it wasn't for the pigs, if it wasn't for Obama and greed, right? We have no problems. We have the solutions to all our problems. I'm always studying these solutions, looking for new ones, right? I'm all about studying what's out there that's being kept from us and what's out there that's coming.
Lay one on us, Julius. What's one way to fix the future and make it better and survive?
Well, you know, it's like somebody said, it's all about the evolution of consciousness, right? I mean, that's the most important thing, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And the new age, yeah, whoever you said, you know, has a problem with that term new age, I'm Mr. New Age, right? I believe science is a lie, but many scientific solutions can solve a lot of our problems. On an absolute sense, I believe science is a lie, but we are trapped in this scientific reality for the time being until we can evolve our consciousnesses. Mm-hmm. So there are many solutions out there that are being kept from the world. There's millions of them. We have no problems.
I mean, like,
Obama is our only problem now.
You mean like zero-point energy?
There you go. I mean, one of a million, right?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this one guy, the governor of California, said, well, you must be a fraud because he had this machine that allegedly put out energy for free, right? But his machine was based on very well known simple laws of physics, right? And he said, they threw him in jail without a trial. And he said, look, if you think I'm a fraud, you can take my design, you can build my machine yourself, and you'll prove to yourself that I'm not a fraud. But of course, they wouldn't do that because they wanted to believe he was a fraud because that's what the oil companies wanted them to believe. So they just threw him in jail.
Who was this?
Julius. Oh,
yeah.
Who was this?
Go ahead. Oh, I'll get his name for you some other time. I can't remember his name.
Okay,
right,
great.
Now.
Well, listen, we have another caller. So
right on. Thank
yeah,
you
thanks
so
for
much.
Checking
thanks
in,
so
Julius.
Much,
look
right
forward
on.
To
appreciate
traveling
you
in your time machine sometime. Okay, you're on Dr. Future.
Oh, I guess we didn't get him quite in time. So hey, we're back with our guests.
Well, I have a thing about the spiritual thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think the only way we're going to live at these kind of population densities is for people to recognize the earth is sacred.
Yeah.
To treat it with infinite respect. You know, when I was in Peru some years ago, I was talking to these German guys who were working with an NGO down there, and they could not get these Quechua people in the Lake Titicaca area to plow virgin land. They said it was a desecration of Pachamama. And they would plow fields that had already been plowed, even Inca fields. But they wouldn't go where no one had plowed before. Now, that's taking it to an extreme.
Now, you're saying they actually had arable land that they weren't using because it was sacred land?
The plow was a desecration of the skin of the mother, or some formulation like that. But, you know, if we treat the world with reverence, don't waste. You know, I grew up in a Quaker household, and we were thrifty.
Yeah.
The whole idea of waste, my mother would go ballistic to see good stuff thrown away. It just didn't happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, the waste that we do, we have these days is just it's just ridiculous.
Mind-boggling.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, so reducing, simplify. Not only are you getting more prepared for the future when you simplify, but actually you're going to have a happier present because you're freed up. Your energy's freed up. You know how much time we spend dealing with stuff? You know, fixing stuff or getting, you know, going through stuff or whatever. It's
unprecedented, but never before in the history of the species have we been able to have so much stuff. It's right. Almost like we have to go through this phase of having an abundance of stuff before we reach a balance with it.
Yeah.
We live like upstairs, downstairs, you know, that BBC series.
Yeah.
A washing machine is the equivalent of one servant.
Well, I think Bucky Fuller said back in the 70s that the average American household has the equivalent of 12 Roman slaves.
I would say that's about right. Yep.
Yeah, so all this has come at great cost, though.
Thanks to our
technology.
And
the cost
is
the planet. Yeah.
Well, the technology manufacturing processes, yeah, which have been very resource intensive. However, yeah, I think we are at a phase where we're switching over to a more efficient, more economical form of technology.
The whole thing about industrial ecology, where you have, well, the classic one was making plasterboard from the sulfate waste from coal-fired power plants. They scrub all the sulfur dioxide out. Well, you can make sheetrock out of it. There's probably only so much sheetrock you can make, but that's the general principle. Waste, if you've got enough of something in a pile, it doesn't matter what it was, someone can find a use for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just when it's distributed in little bits that it becomes the problem.
So maybe if we know where more of our stuff is, we can recycle it better.
Yes.
You know?
And we're gaining the technology now, amazing technology out there for ways to turn around the horrible damage that we've done to the planet. I mean, people have come up with microbes that will eat plastic and things like that. I mean, it's just like incredible stuff out there. It's not really implemented yet that I know of, obviously, and not in a big way. I don't know how much, even in a small way. But we have the brains to do this.
Yeah, we try to report on stories like that.
Yeah, we have the ability to turn around what we've done, the damage we've done. But what we don't have yet is enough of the will on a big enough scale, and
the collective
that's
where
will the consciousness
too.
Point comes in.
Uh-huh. So when we have the collective will to make this place
we
better,
need the collective will, and the collective will is a direct result of the collective consciousness
and the collective conversation.
Yes, and the conversation is, in my opinion, conversation is very much one, and you know, very much part of the consciousness. To me, they're almost one and the same.
Well, how can we ask the right questions? You know, I feel like our conversation today has been focused on hypothetical catastrophes and, you know, spiritual solutions that are kind of about, you know, being healthy and holding yourself in a good place. But, you know, how can we be a little more intentional in having a positive focus?
Store up food.
It's a good thing to have a cushion. Now, here's something. Here's how I put it once years ago. I think people will do anything for money, even the right thing. So if you make it more profitable or cheaper to do the right thing vis-a-vis the climate, the ecology of the planet, then people will do it. So you know, there are these things called pernicious subsidies. It used to be cheaper to transport iron ore than it was to scrap iron on the railroads. The ICC had those rules back in place in the 60s. I don't know when they took them out, but I think they have by now. So there was it was more expensive to recycle iron than it was to produce iron from ore.
Well, that drives the equation, that's for sure. Yeah, it's the economic engine.
It's crazy.
But still today, it costs more, though, to eat healthy, to buy it, to shop at Whole Foods than it is the Safeway.
Yeah, but not if you are learning how to grow your food. And there are simple things you can do that you can eat really healthy. And that's, you know, that's the education piece that needs to get more out there. Sprouts. Get seeds and legumes and sprout them. You have your enzymes, you have your chlorophyll, you have your protein. It's an incredible food, and it's very cheap.
My experience is that growing my own food is such an expensive thing to do with my time.
Yeah.
Well, sprouting is not that time consuming, actually.
Sure. Sprouting is one small piece. But, you know, I actually am thinking in a whole different term, because as much as I appreciate self-sustainability and self-sovereignty, I believe that the future requires us to be more efficient and to work on a more efficient economy of scale. So I am really into thinking about village economics and what kind of incentives can motivate mass groups of people to be more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And,
you know, I think... Well, that's exactly what the Transition Town is about. It's a U.S.-wide network now that is looking at exactly that, what you're talking about.
And so what are some of those ways of thinking? How do we go from the individual household being the target of every profit-making plan to the neighborhood, the village, the town, the city? You know, how do we get the economic clout back into the hands of the little guys working together? I mean, that seems to me the problem, that we've got so much inefficiency because of the wasteful excess of centralized big government, but we don't have enough empowerment at the level of small groups of people working together.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what we need to be doing. We don't have enough of it now, but we're working in that direction, and it is going to be bottom up. We are the change that the planet is needing right now, I honestly don't believe is going to happen top down. Yes, we need regulations. Yes, we need policy change, but it's going to happen maybe, and not enough, and not enough time. We need a grassroots movement that's bottom up, people changing, ordinary people like you and me in our own local communities, in our own neighborhoods, just doing what we can do for each other. I mean, forming little pods of neighborhoods and just trading with each other, because even in a neighborhood, you have a lot of skills and resources just right there. You can have a neighborhood garden. You can have, you know, this is what we need to be doing.
We have a woman in our neighborhood who's been doing that, looking at how to coordinate each neighborhood resources so that it's more efficient, and people are able to have, you know, group meals. They're able to share resources. Mechanical capabilities.
Oh, let me see. Are you talking about the Food in the Hood movement?
Yeah, Food in the Hood movement.
Okay, so you know, this was a woman that we nominated to be at TED this year, who's a local activist, and this is a good idea for you guys, if you haven't implemented such a thing already.
In Sebastopol.
Food in the Hood is a monthly potluck gathering of people who know each other, and they get together and they have a gourmet, wonderful meal. And during that meal, they plant a garden at the participant's house.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so everybody, it's a win-win for everybody. The person hosting the meal gets a group of people to come over and socialize and help. And the group has cultivated a certain amount of intelligence about what makes a good garden in this area. And it's a social club, you know. So those kinds of solutions, I think,
are... Like a fundraising.
Yeah,
modern-day barn raising, a garden.
Well, that's exactly what we need to be doing. And as part of Transition, I do hold a monthly gathering myself, more for the kind of the nurturing spiritual resiliency. We gather together around the fire, outdoors, where we feel that connection with the earth. It reconnects us with nature. And we sing, and we share from our hearts. It's just a place where, you know, it's like, you know, get away from the TV, get away from, you know, the mass media, and just have time with each other in a circle, just like people have been doing for thousands and thousands of years. It's in our genes. It's in our cells. I mean, to do this, and this is the way we're going to survive, is when we have this kind of community happening, when we build these kinds of communities where we're nurturing each other, where we feel good. Mm-hmm. Who wants to?
Yeah, we have about 30 seconds left.
Who wants to survive in a world where you're not feeling good?
I see. So bottom line, simplify, get back to feeling great.
Yeah. And it's important to know your neighbors, and it's important to figure out how to be helpful to your neighbors in ways that make your life better as well.
Okay, and any final thoughts, Richard?
I'll talk about giant meteorite impacts on the next round.
Okay, we'll keep you going. These guys are part of our extended family here. We'll be bring them back as issues come up that require their awareness.
So
thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here, and appreciate
Richard
your
Ely, Julia right. Bistrova.
It was great.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Have a great day, you guys.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This has been the Dr. Future Show, KSEO Santa Cruz, and we'll see you again next week.
Yeah. Thanks for coming.
Before you know it, you're there. Living in the future in a plastic dome. Sounds mighty strange, I agree. But now I call it home, sweet home. That's where I long to be, yeah. Living in the future in a plastic dome. Sounds mighty strange, I agree. But now I call it home, sweet home. That's where I long to be. Now if you're hungry for food or drink, just go to the teller machine.